sources.
Yes. Love it. Love it. And that mismatch, right? I love that you brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes you can maybe be a genius or something, but if you don't have the nurturing environment,
right,
nothing will happen. Well, thank you so much. I feel so grateful that you colored our stage. And how do people get a hold of you?
I have a website, rhythmandautism.com. I'm available to do things like opening slots, shared bills. I would love to share a bill with other like-minded performers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working on getting some more of my own full-length shows out there. I've got a few irons in the fire, but if you want to be on my mailing list, just come to my website and drop your email address in there, and we'll let you know when the next one's happening.
That's wonderful. Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And again, this has been All My Greatest Teachers Showed Me Love, found here only on KBOO Portland. Be kind to yourself and others out there.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Solve, bringing communities together across Oregon and Southwest Washington to clean and restore neighborhoods and natural areas year-round. More information on leading or joining a cleanup with tools and support this Earth Month is available at solve.org.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Northwest Hub Bike Shop, presenting a benefit concert headlined by Rick Estrin and the Nightcats at the historic Grand Theater in Salem on April 19th. Tickets and information at salemshg.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. Next up is the Bike Show.
To keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Show, coming from the studio of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. My name is Alon Robb, and I'm joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler and engineer Ty Walker. Since the last show, the bloodshed in the Middle East continues, as do the assaults on democracy in the U.S. I hope this finds you and your loved ones as well as could be during these challenging days, and that the wars for oil and empire give way to a peaceful and just country and world. A special greeting and an embrace to my friend Gonenk in Turkey, who is listening, And congratulations on your country reaching the World Cup. And a special greeting also to his sweet dog named Baikal, named for the Siberian lake. As always, we will be joined by two inspiring guests providing good medicine for these challenging times. In the first half, our guest is Christopher Sweet, professor in information literacy and scholarly communication librarian at Illinois Wesleyan University, and author of A History of Bicycling in Illinois, 160 Years of Booms and Busts. In the second half, Nedra will speak with Lisa Watts, writer, editor, avid runner, bicycle tourist and activist, and yogi. Ms. Watts is the author of the books Crossing Bridges, What Biking Up the East Coast Taught Me About Life After 60, and also the book Curb Appeal, 40 Years of Falling for Houses and Finding Home. Before we get to the news, I'd like to say hello to my co-host. Nedra, are you online? Nedra, can you hear me? Having trouble hearing my co-host Nedra, so hopefully she'll come on presently. So let me just go straight ahead to some news items from the bicycle universe. Paris has a new mayor, Emmanuel Grigory, and when he leapt on a bike for a victory tour along the French capital's large network of new cycle lanes, he was using a form of transportation he loves and sending an important message to residents. In the past decade, Paris has made fantastic progress in its move towards a greener and more ecologically sustainable city, in doubling the number of cyclists and investing millions of euros in infrastructure. The new mayor promised to keep building bike lanes and keep limits on cars in the center of the city. And he also promised to shrink Paris officials' hefty expense accounts and end the use of chauffeur-driven cars. Grigory, who has worked at City Hall for over a decade, represented a united grouping of socialists, Greens, and other parties on the center-left, delivering a fifth consecutive mayoral term for the socialists in Paris. May more cities elect leaders who care about cycling and livability. A new film about bicycles shot in Portland, Oregon, is out and making the festival rounds. Titled A Simple Machine and directed by Mark Hoffman, it centers on, in the words of the film's creators, a thoughtful but indecisive young man with a marketing job who is drowning in debt and in an attempt to regain his freedom abandons his career, sheds all unnecessary possessions, and goes off-grid, devoting himself to fixing up an old bike. He might end up homeless and alone, or he might just find an unconventional formula for reclaiming one's life. For information on screenings, check asimplemachinethemovie.com. And we hope that in a future show we will speak with director Mark Hoffman. And speaking of Portland, the city is starting an e-bike rebate program offering e-bike buyers an instant rebate of up to $1,600 for a standard e-bike or up to $2,350 for a cargo e-bike plus $300 for accessory. As BikePortland.org reports, cyclists at or below 60% of the area median income and those in groups which the program defines as, quote, disproportionately impacted by climate change and historically underserved by sustainability program are eligible. The funding, $20 million over 5 years, comes from the Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund and is expected to provide over 6,000 bikes. An online application and a basic safety training course completed online or required. If interested, check the website portlandbikerebate.com. And finally, to prove that it is never too early to start cycling, a Minneapolis lawmaker rode an e-bike sidecar to deliver her baby. State Representative Katie Jones does not own a car and usually takes light rail or rides a bicycle to the Minnesota State Capitol. When it was time to give birth, she and her husband loaded themselves into her friend's cargo e-bike, with Jones riding in the sidecar. They had also packed an infant car seat, so after their son Hans was born, they placed him in the seat for the ride home, probably the first of many rides. Representative Jones thanked the city of Minneapolis for having protected bike lanes that she says made the two-mile ride feel safe. All the best to the parents and to baby Hans. May you grow up in a city, country, and world safe from federal violence and where bicycles and the joy they bring prevail. And those were just a few news items from the wide world of bicycles. I will try to connect again with my co-host, Nedra. Are you online? Nedra? Don't know. Seems like we're having trouble. But Nedra will join us at the half-hour mark. And now it's time for our first guest. In the early 1890s and early 1900s, Chicago Mayor Carter Henry Harrison IV was a passionate cyclist who rode thousands of miles yearly. During his 1896 campaign, 100,000 postcards bearing his image astride a bicycle with the caption, "Not the champion cyclist, but the cyclist champion," were distributed, helping him win the first of his five terms as mayor. And in the 1930s, gangster Al Capone was rumored to be in the popular bicycle racing business, betting on winners, sometimes buying off racers, and backing a lucrative six-day race in Chicago. His venture into the world of cycling ended with him sending some of his muscle men after the race organizer, who had to flee town hidden in a laundry basket. Harrison and Al Capone are but two of the individuals, along with suffragettes, environmentalists, riders, bicycle manufacturers, racers, advocacy groups, and cycling clubs, appearing in the just-published and well-researched book, A History of Bicycling in Illinois, 160 Years of Booms and Busts, by Christopher Sweet. Professor Sweet is a professor in information literacy and scholarly communication librarian at Illinois Wesleyan University's Ames Library, as well as a cyclist, including atop his 1886 penny farthing high wheel bicycle. Professor Sweet, good day and welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. That was a pretty good introduction with a couple characters from my book.
Yeah, thank you. There's so many characters there, so we'll try to get to some of them. And before we get to your book and the history of cycling in Illinois, I always like to ask our guests, what are some of your early cycling memories?
There's a interesting phenomenon when you have picture evidence that kind of merges with memory. So the earliest, we've got pictures of my dad teaching me to ride in like a hand-me-down BMX. Our front yard had a grass slope to it. And so it's definitely my first memory. I don't know if that was due to the photos or me actually recalling it, but that would have been the earliest. And then not long after that, I grew up in rural central Illinois, so flat rolling, lots of fields. That was the way for me to get around and visit friends and relatives. And it's a little different than an urban setting. Sometimes that might have meant, riding about 4 or 5 miles round trip to my job, mowing the church cemetery, or, 3 miles to go visit a cousin or something like that. So it was very much a means of transportation and getting around in a rural environment for me.
So quite a lot of good memories. And what led you to this particular subject? Of all the subjects in the world, and you being also a librarian, you know how many subjects are waiting to be written. So why this particular one?
So it really started, I had been at Illinois Wesleyan at that point for, 7 years. I was tenured and I got my first sabbatical, which let me work on a substantial research project. Up until that point, I had worked on things closer to library science field of study, but I had a background in history and I'd always wanted to tackle a big history project. I knew a little bit about some of the bicycle history in Central Illinois, enough to kind of pique my interest. And so I started poking around as a librarian does, and started coming across more and more stuff. And so at first I proposed, that I was going to write a scholarly article for a history journal about the history of cycling in Illinois. It really only took about another month or two of research, and I'm like, no, this is it's not an article. This stuff really deserves a book. But I need to teach myself more about bicycle history. I knew American history in general, but not a lot of bicycle history. So I needed that foundation to move on. The other piece of it is in academia, to be published by a university press. You got to identify first like a literature gap that's important to the field. Skeptics might say, well, okay, why then history of bicycling and why bicycling in Illinois? That's awful specific, right? I kind of have a book length argument that yes, this is significant to American history and change. And, I guess it was at least enough of an argument to convince University of Illinois Press to publish the book. So the literature gap and then proximity to materials, in this age of AI and digitization, everybody thinks everything is online, and for history, that's not even close to the truth. It was more feasible for me to travel to Chicago. I'm about 2 hours away from Chicago in Central Illinois, so it's easy for me to take a train or something up there to go to the archives at the Newberry and Chicago History Museum, or just travel around the Midwest. So those were kind of the reasons that led me to Illinois bicycle history.
You're listening to The Bike Show, coming from the studio of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. My name is Alon Rapp, and I'm speaking with Christopher Sweet, author of A History of Bicycling in Illinois, 160 Years of Booms and Busts. Who were the first bicyclists in the state of Illinois, as far as you discovered?
Yeah, so we get a little bit of bicycle history terminology, I think, to start this off. There's been multiple iterations or evolutions of what we know as the bicycle. The first ones that were used in Illinois were the ones that people call velocipedes or bone shakers. They almost all had a steel rim, and then it was either wooden or steel spokes. And so you can imagine steel over cobblestones that would give you kind of a bone-shaking ride. These were developed and invented in Paris the mid-1860s, and they found their way pretty quickly to Illinois by 1868, which is, I think, a little bit of a story in and of itself how fast the technology and the idea of a bicycle progressed from Europe to the States. But I think my book argues that we do know who was the first person to ride a bicycle in Illinois, a guy named Augustus Wheeler. It's a great last name for a cyclist. So there was a newspaper documentation of him riding one of these velocipedes in August of 1868 in Chicago. There was a little bit of a write-up. And it was pretty quickly after that, the first of the booms that the book describes in the subtitle. There was then a boom that happened in urban areas across the country, Chicago for sure. It only lasted about 2 years, but Mr. Wheeler was the first that I was able to find.
Who is the first is always kind of a tricky question. Were there people before it was reported? When I wrote History of Women Cyclists in the Middle East, I, looked at all the archives and papers. It was still kind of, I had to rely on newspaper reports. What did the process of writing the book involve? And in your many diggings in archives, libraries, have you come across any particular and interesting librarians who helped you or gave you hell?
Oh, yeah, man, I bet we could do...
That's another book,
a half hour or more on this. I really enjoyed the opportunity to get out and get into physical archives. That was part of the appeal of working in the field of history for this this project. I teach a lot of online research, and online research is great. It saves a lot of time. You can cover a lot of ground. But there's really nothing like showing up at an archive and digging through their stuff and having these little discoveries. And there were so many of these little discoveries. So a couple that come to mind. One, the Chicago History Museum had this scrapbook that a couple scrapbooks I really wanted to see. It was a bicycle racer who's in the book called Charlie Miller, who was a six-day racer. And the librarian, they couldn't find it. I had the citation, and they said, "Well, we know where it's supposed to be. We can't find it." And so I left, and then like a couple months later, I emailed them and like, "Well, we still don't know where it is." And I was persistent, and they're like, "Oh, it's in preservation because it's in such bad shape." But I really wanted this thing, so then I got in touch with the conservationist at the Chicago History Museum. Like, "Well, it's kind of falling apart, but like if I oversee and I turn the pages for you, you know, then you can see this scrapbook." So I made another trip up there, and she started out turning the pages for me, and I was taking pictures of the material. And then she said, "Well, you can do this." So I was able to see the scrapbook on my own. So that's one good archive story. The other one, I don't know if you've ever covered the Bicycle Museum of America is in New Bremen, Ohio.
Oh, no, never have.
Yeah, it's kind of a unique place. So the bulk of their collection, there used to be a Schwinn Museum owned by the Schwinn family and the Schwinn Company that was in Chicago. When they went bankrupt and were sold, their whole archive was sold. It was bought by this guy who moved it all to New Bremen, Ohio. He's got hundreds of bikes and some great bikes on display, but they also have archives. But this it was very different. They really don't know what they have. They just have so much stuff. So they gave me essentially a key to a closet that had a big closet, and they're like, "Well, see what you can find in there." It was, you know, totally unsupervised. They just let me dig through. I found a lot of good catalogs and stuff, but that was kind of wild compared to a university archive.
Our time is just flying by like one of those races you described so well in the book. So we won't get, unfortunately, to questions like the bike manufacturing. At 1.2-thirds of all bicycles sold in the U.S. were manufactured within a 150-mile radius of Chicago, the races, and other things I would like. So I urge people to look at your wonderful book. But you devote considerable space to the history of women's cycling in the state. What are some of the highlights in the history of women's cycling, and maybe some notable riders that left a mark, you know, an impression on you?
So this is part of the argument, right, that this is a significant literature gap, and one of the ways that I prove that point, or if I don't prove it, I argue strongly in favor of that point, was to look at the ways that the bicycle boom overlapped with the progressive era was at the same time coming to a head around this 1890 period. So women were, especially in urban areas in the States, they were starting to come out against those Victorian social norms. Like, so the Victorians, right, they still believed that women's place was like the hearth in the home, right, the kitchen in the home, caring for children. Victorian dress, right, those were the great big hoop skirts and crinoline, whalebone corsets, that sort of thing. So you couldn't ride a bike in those, for example. So there was a thing called the rational dress movement. Rational dress movement said, "Hey, we need a goal of getting women's dresses down to below 7 pounds." That was their goal, was to be under 7 pounds. And because so many men were riding, they wanted women to come along in the rides and join the clubs and outings and stuff with them. They were really one of the leaders of the dress reform movement. So what else I think is important, a lot of women started riding long distances, and the physicians are like, no, this is going to be, it's detrimental to your health, it's going to cause infertility, it's going to cause all these different medical maladies if you ride this much. And as women did this for years, especially a lot of Chicago and Illinois women, year after year, they started riding centuries. Some of them rode 10,000 miles or more per year. And, you know, guess what? Hey, they were still able to have kids after all this. And so the, you know, the medical journals had to kind of go back and reevaluate. Well, maybe some exercise is okay, and women can handle it.
And you also, one of the fascinating individuals is the champion racer Tilly Anderson, whose competitors nickname her Tilly the Terrible Swede. As we have only about 6 minutes, I'd like to jump a little bit to the conclusion of your book. You know, you quote from newspapers in the 1890s claiming that bicycles have democratized the world and made everything equal. And you note that it was mostly white male cyclists. And you also mention that we still have a long way to go. But you do mention that then some projects, contemporary projects, that are trying to address that gap between that goal and reality. Could you mention some of those current bicycling project in Illinois?
Yeah, right. So this is in the course of doing this research, I picked up on this thread about how during the boom, a lot of people talked a big game about how cycles, bicycling, were going to create a more just and egalitarian society, but they really only meant it for a certain amount of people. So I traced this argument throughout the book, and I really start to see progress in the last 30 years or something. So what does that progress look like? If the Portland area listeners are going to be very familiar with bike co-ops. Chicago has had a lot of very big and successful bike co-ops. Blackstone Bicycle Works is one of them, and Working Bikes up in Chicago, that recycle abandoned the bicycles, teach people how to work on bicycles, employ people, and they've been doing this for years. Some of the bikes stay in the community. Some of them are shipped off to other countries. So there's an example of where, they're starting to do the thing and actually address these social justice issues. Bike share programs, and particularly the Chicago program called Divvy for Everyone, that has extremely reduced rates for people with lower socioeconomic classes to be able to use the bike share programs. They've been pushing the bike share stations out into underserved populations. This took a long time. It wasn't initially that way. They've really been doing good work in the last 5 years up in Chicago of thinking about, are we placing these in the most the areas of need? There's a couple of the big ones, I think.
And one of the many things I learned from your book was the connection between cycling and environmental awareness. You write about the bicycle ecology group in the 70s. I'm always fascinated by, you know, those that came before us. So finally, what's next for you? Are you ready to invest another 10 years of your life in such a project, or are you going to devote it to? You also write a lot about literacy, about truth, post-truth. What's next for you?
It seems to be a pretty common question when I go out and I give presentations about the bike book. Like, what are you working on? What are you doing next? I'm still in the sort of poking around phase, which, as both a librarian and historian, I actually quite like this phase. Mm-hmm. So, I need to get the next project right, because I don't want to spend 3 years working on something and then burn out on that project. That would be such a waste of time and effort. So, it's likely to be another history project, but, not necessarily. I think when I come across it and stumble across it, I'll probably know. I would love for it to be less than a 10-year project, but that's kind of the nature of things in academia.
And that's why your next book is written by an AI machine, right? No, heaven forbid. Heaven forbid.
Absolutely none of that.
No.
None of that.
Well, the book, I enjoyed your book immensely, and you just make so many wonderful connections. You have wonderful stories. So I thank you for that and wish you all the best in whatever your next ride is. We have been speaking with Christopher Sweet, author of A History of Bicycling in Illinois, 160 Years of Booms and Busts, published by Three Fields Books, an imprint of the University of Illinois Press. Thank you, Professor Sweet, for being our guest today, and all the best with your future writing, and cycling. You're listening to The Bike Show, coming from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon. We will take a short musical break, and when we return, co-host Nedra Deadweiler will speak with author and activist Lisa Watts. Stay tuned. Nedra, are you there?
Here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, welcome. We missed you earlier, so.
Yes.
Yeah, if you could speak a little louder. The connection seems to be a little weak, so.
Okay.
Yeah, much better.
How about now?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. Take it away.
Okay, great. Thank you, and welcome back to The Bike Show, coming from KBO Studio in Portland, Oregon. In the first half hour, Alon spoke with Christopher Sweet about the history of cycling in Illinois. Now, I will speak with Lisa Watts, writer, editor, avid runner, bicycle tourist and activist, and yogi. Lisa is the author of the books Crossing Bridges, What Biking of the East Coast Taught Me About Life After 60, and Curb Appeal, 40 Years of Falling for Houses and Finding Home. Lisa, how are you? Welcome to KBOO.
I can't reach her yet.
Okay.
Today we're having some technical problems, unfortunately, but hopefully Lisa Watts will be back on the show. In the meantime, I'll ask you, Nedra, how are things with you in your part of the world?
In my part of the world? I think things are coming pretty okay. Mm-hmm. The azaleas are blooming, and so my yard is full of azaleas, so this is my favorite time of the year. It's really, it's colorful. And the dogwood is out, so yeah, it's really beautiful. And over the weekend, I was at a farm, so that also was quite enjoyable. And how are you doing?
I'm okay, as always. You know, I say within my little sphere, there are many blessings, but the country and the world situation. But on the good note, here in Portland, also things are blooming. The cherries are amazingly beautiful. What was this farm like? What kind of farm was it?
It's a farm that allows for like immigrant refugee people to have plots and farm. It was started by 13 African women who were in the same capacity, you know, arrived in the U.S. as immigrant and refugee, and so they have stewarded this, like, these lands, like, it's different plots of land around the metro area, and so it just allows people to grow food for them and their families that's culturally appropriate, you know.
Sounds like a nice place. Sounds like a nice place. Lisa, are you on? Still not on. I'm sorry for these technical problems here. So, and have you been busy working on any projects yourself, writing, organizing, as you always do?
Yeah, it's like I'm trying to do so many things. You know, it's hard to focus. I'm on this long time project, which I should have finished, I feel like, well before now. And it's researching, a community, where, like, urban renewal, the black residents were pushed out. It became a park, Candler Park, associated with Asa Candler Sr. of Coca-Cola, founder of Coca-Cola brand. So that is very interesting, and I've spent some time recently at the Atlanta History Center doing some research, looking at maps, trying to see, like, parcel maps, trying to find that area on a map, just tracing, like, land ownership, and which is kind of tough. Yeah.
Excuse me just for a second. Our engineer wants to fill me in what's going on.
Double check the phone number.
What?
Double check the phone number.
And the phone, we're having trouble reaching Lisa. The number I have for her, this is the number, right?
Let's see.
Yeah, we're sort of.
Okay.
336-541. Yeah. Lisa, I don't know. This is.
She said she's waiting for a call. She emailed me.
Okay.
So I'm just going to forward it to you online.
Okay, and I'll send her. And again, to our listeners, I'm really sorry for these technical problems here, but that's okay. Yeah, send me that, please, Nedra. And to our listeners, you're listening to The Bike Show, but today it's having more technical problems than usual, so I'm sorry for that. And we'll hopefully fix this problem here and get on with the show pretty fast here. So I'll send this to Lisa and
okay. I'm sending her the station number as well. I'll send it to her, but I'm sending it again.
Okay. Nedra, in the meantime, if you could maybe tell us a little bit more about the history project that you're working on.
Yeah. I'll do my best.
Okay.
It's It's in partnership with this organization, which is a part of the Candler Park community. It's a biracial history project based in Candler Park, and which Candler Park was originally known as Edgewood. You know, at the edge of the woods, there was this town that sprang up on the Atlanta, not the Atlanta, the Georgia Railroad. So, you know, there was a railroad that stretched between Decatur and Atlanta and throughout Georgia. But Candler Park is like equal distance from Decatur and Atlanta. So it's set in the middle. And it was most of people lived around the railroad. And this is like, you know, what is that? Late 1800s or so. It eventually got annexed into the city of Atlanta around 1911. And there was a number of like small towns like Kirkwood, what are neighborhoods now, got annexed into the city limits of Atlanta. So the boundary continued to grow, which also helped to maintain historically like a white majority. But this neighborhood was, as the project, Biracial History Project name tells us, it was, you know, it was multiracial. Black and white people lived in this neighborhood or this city, this township.
All right. We have Lisa Watts on the line. And Lisa, I apologize to you for these difficulties and also to our listeners. So, Nedra, smooth sailing from now on, please.
Okay, great. Thanks for listening to me, Filibuster. Lisa, how are you? Welcome in.
I'm good. Yes, nice to talk with you.
I think this has been a long time coming. It's been fun to trace you from your time at East Coast Greenway, and watching,
right,
you know, talk about your travels and all, you know, everything that you're involved in on LinkedIn, to have you here on KBOO. So would like to just kind of start with some writings and just like really where you're from. You grew up in Ohio and you edited an anthology, Good Roots, Writers Reflect on Growing Up in Ohio. What is it about Ohio that inspired you to consider this project?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I didn't actually grow up in Ohio. I was born there in Cleveland, the youngest of five kids. So my older sisters kind of grew up there. But when we were three, we moved to Atlanta, which is familiar to you. Then fast forward another 35 years or so, my husband got a job in a little college town in the middle of Ohio. We moved there with our two kids. And they went through grade school and junior high there. And I just got to thinking, I had been such an East Coaster from Atlanta to Baltimore to Boston. What would it mean for my kids to grow up in Ohio as it was looking like they would? And I realized some of my favorite writers had grown up in Ohio, like Susan Orlean and Anthony Durr, the Pulitzer Prize winner, a bunch of them. And I just started thinking about this anthology, like how fun it would be to collect all these very successful writers and ask them to submit essays about their Ohio childhood. And it was my job to write the introduction and try to find something, a common thread. And what I decided is a classic Midwest childhood, you know, like Ohio is just a place of not much pretension. And I could see that from my kids. I could see it in our little town. And I think the effect is it allows you to dream because you are, you know, you've just got this sort of classic small town childhood without a lot of stresses. And that was kind of a fun thing to see. Anyway, it was a great project. And we since left Ohio. And one reviewer noted about the anthology, all of those writers left Ohio, but that's okay. They left their childhood there, so...
Right. You don't have to stay. Take those roots wherever you go.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Thanks for coming to Atlanta, you know, bringing those good roots down here, too. So,
Yeah, well, we left when I was going into seventh grade, which is a pretty awkward, you know, time of life, and all my older sisters had gone through high school in Atlanta. I was just devastated. I thought I would stay too, but, you know, we moved three times as I was growing up, and it's, in the end, it's good for you. It makes you stronger.
Yes, definitely, especially someone who continues to travel and also travel by bike, which it's, I mean, reading your stories has been very fascinating and enjoyable. I'm wondering if you could share about early life experiences that helped you to, that inspired you to have this connection to bicycling.
Sure, yeah. Well, it was suburban Atlanta when I learned how to ride a bike. I don't know if I was five or six, but I loved it instantly. And, you know, I'm sure it's a feeling most people share, just like instant freedom, you know, because you sort of travel under your own power. And I was a weird little kid. You know, I read a lot. I kind of lived in my head. And that just kind of carried over to riding my bike. I would ride around our driveway and pretend I was like pulling a covered wagon. And then when we lived in Baltimore in my sort of awkward junior high years, I read a book about a 16-year-old boy who sailed around the world. And I decided, like, oh my God, that's freedom. And so I would go off on my bike and I would pretend I was sailing. I had never been on a sailboat. So I think, you know, it's that same feeling I still feel today, and I think many adults get it. You hop on your bike and you're instantly a kid. It's like a time machine, and it's something about freedom, you know, and it's fun. And I always have that association. So
Yeah, I can understand and relate to that, especially in Atlanta. I mean, now the only way to kind of have some freedom is on your bike, because otherwise you're in traffic. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Just pedal right by those poor cars.
Yes, yes. Like, join us. You know, this is the way to do this.
We're a little bit happier. Website, yep.
Say it again.
We're a little bit happier on our bike than those people are stuck in traffic, you know.
Oh, yes, definitely happier. Tap into some joy. On your website, you described yourself as someone who writes about place and change, which is also interesting, especially when you're doing at the pace of being on a bike. And I'm wondering if you can share more about, like, what about place and what about change that you're writing about? And is it the speed?
Yeah, you know,
on a bike, you know.
Right. It's those are just great questions. Thank you for that. And I think it's what made me pay attention to you and your work when you were doing a volunteer gig with the East Coast Greenway, and you did part of our river relay. And I read about your background. You know, you lead tours that look at the history of places and talk about that. I love all that stuff. And your questions are great. I realize place kind of is a muse. And, you know, in one sense, I've worked for a lot of nonprofits and do that kind of writing. And it's more, you know, I don't know, official. But personally, the change, so I just wrote a second memoir this past year about why my husband and I have bought 15 houses over the last 40 years and moved so often. I really needed to figure it out. All our friends have thought we're crazy all these decades. And I had to be honest and say there's a part of it that is reinvention. You know, every time we moved, whether it was from, you know, New England to Ohio, Ohio to North Carolina, or even 2 miles away in the same town in a new house, I would think, okay, in this place now, I'm a new person, and I'm going to be a better mom, a better housewife. I'm going to cook more. There's an aspect of reinvention about places that are new. And if you're a sensory person, if sights and sounds and smells and all of those things mean something to you. I think place is a muse. You know, I think it's why we all love to travel. We're stimulated by new sights and sounds. And so in the whole realm of biking, I always clarify that I'm a bicycle tourist. I have never been, you know, a fast Peloton, you know, Lycra kit. And biking has never been that to me. It's always been about travel. And I'm sure you would agree. It's one of the finest ways to travel because of how much you experience places. You know, you smell, you hear, you see, you can touch things. And to me, that's just incredibly appealing and low cost and good for you. And all of those other things as well.
Apologies to you, the listeners, and also to our guests. So hopefully we'll be able to reconnect with Lisa again. I don't know what is the problem today, but we're working on it. So stay over there. Stay listening to our show, please. Nedra, are you on?
She got disconnected. So did the guest.
Okay. Nedra? Lisa, are you on? Okay. We'll hope that
Ned on?
Yeah, Nedra, are you on?
On?
Uh huh.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I could hear you now. And is Lisa
okay.
on?
She got just disconnected.
Okay. Lisa, are you on there? Can you hear me?
I'll email her. Your message.
Okay. Well,
let me read the station break, maybe. You're listening to the bike show coming from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon. I am co-host Nedra Deadweiler and was in conversation with activist and author Lisa Watts, author of Crossing Bridges, What Biking Up the East Coast Taught Me About Life After 60, and Curb Appeal, 40 Years of Falling for Houses and Finding Home. And we lost her just recently and trying to get her back.
And in the meantime, Lisa mentioned an organization where you worked also, the Greenways.
Well, I was on the advisory board, and one of the board members lives here, and there's a part of the Greenway that goes through Georgia into Florida. And we rode that Atiba Mabiwan, and I rode that South Georgia into Florida, ending at Amelia Island. It was.
And
so
Lisa is
fun.
Back on, so take it away. And again, Lisa, I am so sorry for these difficulties, but I'm enjoying what you're saying. So please continue.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right, I'm glad you're here. I'm inspired by your writing, you know, because I feel like you bring us along for the ride, and also like that you're constantly moving. You don't stop, and you are also a person. You bike, you run, you kayak, you do yoga, and so like that spirit of keep moving is very evident. What do you receive from bicycling, you know, with that moving, that forward movement? Is there something that you've learned? Maybe it's in coming from your crossing bridges that you'd like to share, what
sure.
you learned about movement. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think, it started with running and then, you know, moving into long distance running and marathons in my 20s. And that was as much mental as physical. It's just a great way to clear your head. And I've looked into finding friends who like to run, and then often they like to bike, and that's also, it becomes social. So I think it's a physical and mental, you know, feel good. movement does feel good. And I've always done sedentary work. You know, it's always been writing magazines, communications. And so by contrast, being able to get out and, you know, breathe hard, exercise. What I talk about in Crossing Bridges is this funny label of athletic. I've had very, very athletic friends, women friends, and I don't see myself that way. I really struggle with that, but I have tagged along with friends and, you know, run a few marathons and then done a few bike trips. And I think I need to get over it and just say, okay, you're athletic. You enjoy being active. Yeah. It makes you feel good. So it's a tricky thing. It's like, you know, saying you're a writer. It sounds kind of pretentious, but yeah, no, I find so many benefits, movement. You know, I do it for fun. I do it for the social aspect. I do it because it clears my head mostly, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you on that. And you talked about the East Coast Greenway. Will you share what is the East Coast Greenway? And you were there 4 years. And what is, yeah, you know, what is it like riding on the East, on that greenway?
Yeah, East Coast Greenway was my job of passion because, again, I grew up from Atlanta to Baltimore to Boston. I grew up along the East Coast, and I kind of had this dream of, wouldn't that be fun to bike up the East Coast, connect all the dots? And then I found this nonprofit right in North Carolina working to build just that route. And so it's, the dream is a walking and biking path, safe, protected for all users from Key West to Canada, roughly 3,000 miles. I just think it's really cool. And its early founders, about 30 plus years ago, saw it as both, you know, sort of a national route that you could do a long distance trip, and locally, you know, that people could use it locally to commute or just for transportation. So it goes right through so many of the major East Coast cities instead of trying to skirt around it, you know, to take you out into the country. And I love that aspect of it too. So I took the job at the East Coast Greenway Alliance doing communications for them, definitely with the idea that at some point I could do the ride. And so we went through the activity that you were part of, our 25th anniversary. We did a two-month river relay event. I launched a new website, got all these things in place, and then I asked my boss, the director, could I take a two-month leave and just bike up? And he said, you know, this would be great, but please be safe. If something happened to me, that would look really bad for the organization. And so it was like the chance to realize a, you know, 20-year-old dream. A friend that I had started doing longer bike rides with in my 20s had just retired. So it was the two of us, two older women. I was 58 and she was 67, and we took 2 months and we had a ball. I mean, sometimes it was difficult, that much time with another person, but mostly it was terrific, and it really has shaped how I've looked at the rest of my life from 60 on, realizing this is my spiel, Nedra, that so many people fear aging. I truly contend that your 60s can be like your best decade ever because you have, you probably have resources from a life of working. You can be relatively healthy and your time starts to open up if you can cut back on work and or retire. And this is the time to pursue your dreams. And so really that's the biggest takeaway I got from the trip was like the stuff that you've been dying to do, this is a great time to do it. And the route itself is only 30-35% right now on protected paths. It's a long haul to get it all moved onto safe paths. I was used to riding on roads, so that didn't bother me. And I actually people always ask, what was your favorite city or the favorite part of it? Riding into cities, often there's great infrastructure, and you don't know it because, you know, you drive in on the highway 95. You don't realize that there's these bike paths and bike bridges, and it was such a kick to come flying into Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia, and Miami. Like, we got here ourselves. That was always exciting, you know.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And it's good to hear there's life after 60, that the trail opens up literally. In our last minute, can you share where people can find you and find your writing, and what next adventure lies ahead for you?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have a website, mindingthemiles.com, where my books are listed and some recent writing and an email address. So that's awesome if people want to take a look. The road is wide open. we are trying to, we are giving ourselves the month of March away somewhere in our retirement as we've moved back to New England, so we are escaping winter. And we just did a month on the southern coast of Spain that was awesome. And now it's like, okay, now we start dreaming about next winter. So I'm open to suggestions, too.
Okay, that sounds great. So everyone visit Lisa's website and send her some suggestions for where she should travel to next. Lisa, it's been a delight to have you here, and thanks so much for bearing with us with the challenges today.
Sure. Thank you for the invite. It's been a treat. And keep up telling the stories. It's great.
We will. You too. Thank you, everyone, for joining. This has been this bike show coming from KBOO Studio in Portland, Oregon. I'm Nedra Deadweiler. I'd like to thank our guests, Christopher Sweet and Lisa Watts, for their good work and their good spirits, and for joining us on the show. Thank you to co-host Alon Robb, our engineer Ty Walker, and Chris Smith, and Josh Hetrick for making all shows available on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. And a big thank you to our listeners. May all your rides be safe, enlightening, and joyful.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.